Hey, yo, what is a cypher?
We understood Whitesnake as opposed to the Supremes.
The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sataro. This is episode 156, a talk with Keith Shockley. Keith is best known as a member of The Bomb Squad, the historic production team that changed hip-hop in the late 1980s and early 90s with their incendiary work for Public Enemy, Ice Cube, Slick Rick, Bell Biv DeVoe, and countless others. Not to mention their hit remixes for pop stars like Paula Abdul and Janet Jackson. The Bomb Squad's core was Keith, his older brother Hank, their cousin Eric Vietnam Sadler, and Chuck D. But before Keith was helping to create some of the greatest rap albums of all time, he was part of a successful mobile DJ crew called Spectrum City, based out of his hometown of Roosevelt, Long Island. That crew consisted of most of the people who would go on to form the core of Public Enemy and the Bomb Squad. It was with those early days that we started our conversation. We talked to Keith at Crosstown Studios in Harlem. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it drops, subscribe on iTunes. Once you do that, check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, listen to our interview with another iconic producer from hip-hop's golden age, The 45 King, on episode 115. Also, consider helping the show by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. If even a quarter of our listeners contributed just a dollar a month, it would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's the man who helped welcome us to the Terror Dome, Keith Shockley.
Well, I was so blown away when I met you the first time, just like your tales about like Spectrum City and all that shit. Like, but that was so amazing.
Those were the years. I'm actually doing a doc on that now. So I'm starting to put it together. So, you know, it's kind of like everybody that's been with us that came up, and I mean, I was a little dude. We can talk about that, but I was a little dude, man. I was like, my brother, I tagged along with my brother all the time.
Yeah, and that's the crazy thing. Like, you know, 12, 13 years old, hanging out with a generation of DJs who have come up on the show, people like PTJ Jones, Grandmaster Flowers. How'd you end up hanging out with them when you were that young?
I didn't really hang out with them. We just knew about them. And, you know, Long Island was like that suburb that all those cats, because like, you know, Pete's from the Bronx, my boy and all of them was from the Brooklyn side, and you know, they had their little things going on, you know, in those areas. But Long Island was that place, that suburb to come away, and then Roosevelt was like all black town. It was mixed and it moved to all black. And then, you know, Hempstead had his black section. Uniondale was mixed, mostly black. Freeport was definitely mixed. You know, Freeport's where Lou Reed came from. So that was mixed. So it was. But I don't know. But this DJ music scene, everybody loved to come there and hang out and party because one, the girls was cooler. You know, Queens had a lot of hot girls, but with Long Island, we had a, like it was just a cool scene. It was like the Brooklyn and the Queens DJs loved to come out to Long Island because we didn't have. The amount of drama that they had. You know, we had drama, but not like the Queens era coming up in the, you know, 70s, late 70s and the 80s. You know, we was kind of like chill, but then, you know, that drama kind of moved out.
And so these were people like from kind of the disco era.
Disco
right?
era,
but spinning mostly outdoors, right?
Spinning mostly outdoors. Ken Spiderweb, we was just listening to him on the radio. He's from Amityville, and he used to be on WBLS under Frankie Crocker.
WBLS at 3 minutes before 6 o'clock. Kenny Webb here with you on top of things on a Monday morning, July 29th, 1985. Monday, glad to be with you.
Got a big thing. So he was one of the cats that was used to rock with Pete DJ Jones a lot. So and we just like to listen to, you know, I guess, you know, I'm a deal with Roosevelt. You know, my brother, my neighbors and us, we used to listen to WWRL. Hank Spann, Gary Bird, Jerry Bledsoe, and all of them.
256 at WWRL in New York. This is Hank Spann. Definitely glad to have you there for my Saturday affair.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
That was like, that was our music center. You know what I'm saying? AM radio was our music center. And that was to us here, like the only black radio station. You know, Chuck Leonard was there, but he's moved to ABC. You know, yeah, ABC with Cousin Brucey and all that, and they was all over there. Right. But when you went to WWRL, that was all black music. And we was like, wow, you know, Gary Bird used to be, this is the GBE experience. And we used to mimic them, and Frankie Crocker was there. And it was that whole time of, I'm going to say, like, late 60s for me, early 70s, when I started to really understand, you know, what was happening. That was the station we turned to before FM. You know, so that whole scene was about the DJ. We used to mimic the DJs. We used to, you know, it was either sports and music. So us mimicking the DJs, we was like, hey, man, this is something kind of cool. So then my neighbor across the street decided to put him and another guy, decided to put like a radio station in our youth center.
That was the ended up being WRYC.
WRYC, yes, yeah. Yes.
So did that actually, I was a little confused about this. Did this actually broadcast anywhere? Or was
just broadcast in the youth center. You know, it was like, you know, we had, I'm going to give a plug because I work with them. We had PV speakers, the column speakers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because back then it was no DJ equipment. It was like everything was band equipment.
Right.
So we had, and I even have a picture of me in the eighth grade. You know, we took some pictures and DJing for the youth center. We set up a little makeshift room, little makeshift booth. Our amplifier was the PV Guitar Amp 450, and we just wired turntables into each channels. So you had knobs, there was no headphones. And then I think we had a pair of, Pioneer had a pair, I think the PL, I think it was like a PL10. I think we had a pair of everything's belt driven. So there was no, you know, pitch control. There's none of this. So all the stuff everybody doing now.
Really doing beatboxing.
Yeah, we were really doing like, and it was like playing your favorite record after the next. So, you know, there was no such thing as, like I said, no headphones. So we understood, like another guy used to work with us at the time, his name was Alan Prince, but Ujima is converted. So he used to work under Frankie Crocker at WWRL. And he brought that knowledge to the youth center. My neighbor across the street, Crandall, decided like, hey, man, I want to do this thing because he loved Gary Bird. And he just used to mimic him all day long. And then when we put it there, we started to have like a little class where kids can come in. Because the youth center was our hub back then. That was like, you know, it's our rec, that's our boys club. But not even just boys club. I wouldn't even go that like that. It was our rec where girls was there, guys was there, kids would come off the streets. You know, back then, youth center was kind of funded by the government and the state. They, you know, we have all that. And later on, Ronald Reagan took that away. But, you know, but it was that hub where our community in Roosevelt was so close. It was like a family community. Everybody knew everybody, you know, the parents would be like, all right, go to the youth center, hang out, you know, okay, you have some of the street kids there along with the regular kids, but we had all kinds of programs in there. And like I said, the DJ was one of the biggest, one of the most, you know, most one that everybody liked and the one I gravitated to. And then we had the martial arts program where the S4Ws was there doing martial arts, like Griff, Pop, the early one, this other guy used to be with us, Roger Chillis, and all them. They was martial arts experts. Another kid, Duan Chapman, he was another martial arts. And they gravitated to that. But the problem with the martial arts program, the hoods would the thugs that would beat you up would gravitate to it. So on top of them going to rob you at gunpoint.
Now they could really be
they knew martial arts. So it was kind of like you just didn't mess with them, you know?
Yeah.
And the whole martial arts problem came about, you know, all the Bruce Lees and the karate movies in the early 70s became, you know, that thing. But our youth center was our hub. Everybody was there. If a parent couldn't find their kid, was at the youth center. You know, Roosevelt was kind of, you know, we had kids that went to private school, kids that went to public school. So some of the private school kids, their parents were like, we don't want you hanging in the youth center because it's just problems and it's not. And it was mainly the parents actually ran the youth center. And the kids, we did all the activities.
Wow.
So this is how we, you know, came up to do. So as it went on, we decided to do, like, you know, somebody, I don't know who it was, I think the Ujima or my brother was there. I used to tag along. You know, I actually got into it through my brother because I used to always tag along with him. And
right. He's
like, all right, come on, go to youth center. We'll learn this thing about DJ. Oh, that's kind of cool. So within my brother and my friend Crandall across the street, the youth center right side just, hey, man, let's raise money for the youth center. So we threw $2 basement parties. And this
in,
was where,
in your house?
No. In the youth center.
Oh, in the youth center.
Youth center had a basement.
Ah.
So we cleaned out the basement, and then we would bring the equipment from upstairs to downstairs. You know, back then, you dark black light and red lights, it's dark, and you can't see nobody. But they would pack the youth center. And this is where the actual DJing started to come about, you know? But like I said, in Roosevelt, it's so dynamic because there was a bunch of other DJs that was in Roosevelt. We were just one of the ones that, you know, took it the furthest.
Right. And so when did that move to, like, playing at Centennial Park and places like that?
Oh, man. So, because, you know, back then, you didn't have to worry about getting permits. Yeah, like you do now. You got to get permits for everything.
Right.
Another partner of ours, his brother, we call him CA, the DJ, and we're talking about coming into like 76, you know, they would just go set up, you know, because everybody wanted to play music in the park. Because between the youth center, Centennial Park was the next big thing to hang out. Because, you know, we had Roosevelt Park. Roosevelt Park was on the other
side.
Right,
I know that was the big events once a year.
Yeah, like, that was that. And they had a lake, and that was a whole nother environment. But Centennial Park, it sits smack dab in the middle of Roosevelt off major traffic. So Roosevelt Park, there's no traffic. Mostly, like, you got to really go back there. But major traffic, Centennial Park. And everybody knew that because when you came off the parkway and you drove a little bit down, you run right into Centennial Park. So coming from there, everybody used to come set up there because the next thing that we had in Roosevelt was the Centennial Park League basketball games. Those was huge, you know, 70, going into like 75, 77, mm-hmm. 78. Those was huge. Next to the Rucker League.
Right.
That was the next thing coming out. You know, and Rucker League was huge, you know, but.
Even back then.
Yeah, even back then, Rucker League was huge. But cats that sometimes will play in the Rucker League will come down to Centennial Park and play, because now in Centennial Park, you got your stars coming through, like, from college.
Yeah.
You know, so everybody was there. You know, got the cats coming in from the city, coming through, playing. That summer league was huge throughout the 70s and the 80s, like mid-70s and 80s. Summer league was huge because, you know, basketball was that thing. Then some of the DJs would come in, like my guy, CA, the DJ, he'll come in and set up and just start playing music while everybody's playing ball. So it's like a big party. Wow. You know, summer league was like, I think it was Tuesdays and Thursdays. And, you know, at the time, you know, it was free-flowing. You didn't have to, you ran your own community. You're not ran like it is today where you got to go to, everybody ran their own community. So when you really want to have something big, like you wanted to get the county involved, and you really want, and you still had to go to the county for that. But just a little park thing to set up, man, they just go and set up, and the DJs would just get down and just play music. And then some of the Queens guys caught on to it because they knew it was kind of hot. Mm. So you had your guys like King Charles, Infinity Machine, Disco Twins. So Reggie, I know Reggie and Rob are really good. So even Infinity Machine, but the DJ Divine and all them cats.
DJ Divine and the Infinity Machine was a crew of DJs based in Astoria, Queens, that worked steadily from 1977 to 1985. They toured with and provided sound systems for Afrika Bambaataa and the Soul Sonic Force, Super Rhymes, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, Love Bug Starsky, DJ Hollywood, and Eddie Chiba.
King Charles, my man Vern, and all of them used to get down. And they used to come in with, they had the crazy systems. You know, King Charles would come in with like, oh man, with like a wall. Because, you know, these guys was, like King Charles and them, they're from Elmhurst, but they're Jamaicans. So, you know, they come from that Jamaican sound system culture, you know, the King Tubbies and all of them that they learned from. And they used to come to Roosevelt, to Centennial Park, and just set up. Oh, it was phenomenal. We was be like, whoa, like it was crazy because we was in awe, but we understood the mobile DJ world because from us doing it, but right. We wasn't coming in.
We weren't there yet.
Yeah, we wasn't there. The kind of system they had as it built up.
Yeah.
The other side to Roosevelt was at that time in the 70s, roller skating was huge. Out of our area, we had one of the biggest roller skating rings. And a lot of the guys, especially one of my guys, my friend's father, he used to promote a lot of parties because they built the roller skating rink. And while we ain't roller skating, they used to throw concerts in it. So this is mid-70s. So all this, that's why I said Roosevelt was kind of in the middle of the hip-hop culture coming in. So we understood what was happening. So my man Kasim, his father, him, and this other kid, Wildman Steve, they used to throw concerts with bringing in Flash and all of them. And this is at the roller rink. Now, between our roller rink, you had Skate Key up in the Bronx. You had Empire in Brooklyn. And then you had Roosevelt. And then, I mean, there was other roller rinks, but they wasn't as popular as ours on Long Island. You know, Roller Castle in Queens was kind of possible where LL and them used to live around. And Laces, but Laces kind of got popular a little later.
Right, the skating rink thing went through the 80s and went as far as like, I mean, I've heard tales of people doing it in Miami in the
80s. Yeah, the roller skater went through like all the way to the mid 80s, man. Yeah. It was really big.
Yeah.
Because that's where you can get the most amount of people in. And
it's all ages.
Yeah, all ages. And then if they didn't want to skate, they just brought in DJs.
Right.
So I can't even say how we were just doing things. Whatever you thought of, you just did it. Everything had to have a DJ, and DJs brought their own sound system, and that was kind of changed. So between me and my brother, and this was early. This was before Chuck, and it's before Flav.
Right.
Griff came along because Griff lived in back of me. So it was just us, and you know, in the youth center. So. Us by us doing all the parties at the youth center, then we had the talent shows from there. And we was the DJs for the talent show. So we was like, because, you know, well, y'all the DJs, y'all do the talent show.
Right.
And then from there, you know, Eddie Murphy used to host all the talent shows.
Really?
He used to do his, yeah.
He hosted all the
talent shows because he used to do his comedy routines. And, you know, Eddie was doing this. Eddie was doing comedy since he was 15.
Do you remember like what years you sort of first saw him perform and he used to host that stuff?
You know what? Because we all grew up together, we were just doing it. And we just knew he was funny and he was great at doing impersonations. You know, he used to do him and his other guy, Mitchell Kaiser, they used to do Howard Cosell and Muhammad Ali. So Mitchell would do Howard Cosell, but when Eddie did Muhammad Ali, it was exactly like
I'm sick and tired. People saying the same old things every time people walk up in the street. Do I sound like I took too many punches? Everybody saying I got some sick, I'm tired, I'm old, I got brain damage. I'm the greatest fighter of all times. People saying wash up and I'm old, I'm senile. How can you say that after all I've done for you? After all I've done for you, I made you, Cosell.
And this is all in high school.
Right.
Now, we all in high school doing this. So he hosted all of the talent shows, crafting his genius.
Yeah.
So, and then we would just DJ. And I'll do DJ some parties. Eddie will come in, practice some of his routines that he's been doing, because he's been coming to New York, going around these little nightclubs doing right. his thing. So he's like, you know, secretly doing his thing. And then all of a sudden, between that, we had tons of talent shows between the youth center and the high school. So the youth center was more like everybody from the from different communities. The high school was just more about the high school. And we always had this thing called the senior show, where the seniors get together and do all kinds of things, from skits and comedy and routines. And it was kind of incredible back then. You know, there was some cats was really good, martial arts exhibitions. And so that was kind of huge in our high school and coming up. So, like I said, most of the stuff we was just doing it because it's what you did. You didn't have nothing else. You know, what are you going to do? But the culture of the hip hop and the DJs was always there. And, you know, like I said, I make statements like I give the Bronx credit for naming the culture and kind of giving it a direction. But the culture's always been there. A lot of them forget about the Brooklyn DJs with the sound systems and started with
the DJs.
That's
a big, big
thing. That's a big thing, you know, and they was doing it really big. And they was the ones, you know, we had the nightclubs that we couldn't get into. So that's why the mobile DJs became kind of big, you know. So we was, you know, we was just, I think we because of the nature of how everything was, everybody was just immersed into it.
Where did the name Spectrum or Spectrum City, how did that?
Well, Spectrum came about. Now, you gotta say, I'm still young, and my brother, I couldn't go out too many parties, and my mom's like, you only in the eighth grade. you ain't going out like that. And so what happened was, back then, a lot of youth centers used to connect together. And when they wanted a party, they figured, well, we need a DJ. So if a youth center like in Brooklyn knew about something, they thought, well, we need a DJ, and they didn't want to pay a lot of money because you couldn't get the Boys and the Grandmaster Flowers and all, because they doing big stuff. They wanted a little local, and they didn't know anybody, but because of the connections of youth centers talking to each other, they used to call us at our youth center, hey, we want your guys to come in and DJ. So it'd be my brother, this other kid, Ujima, and then Mitch Gibson, and my neighbor Crandall. They used to go and do those parties outside of Roosevelt. And was always in other youth centers. So now the next one, Rockford Center, which is close to us, they will call, well, we need a DJ because we want to have this party. They will just call us. So it kind of just morphed into itself. And there was no name. It was just Roosevelt Youth Center. We'll just call Roosevelt Youth Center. They got some guys that play music. It was like that. So my brother one night was coming home and from a party, and him and Ujima was figuring out, like, well, we kind of need a name. They sat around, and then my brother kind of came up with Spectrum, you know, because what we played, you know, because back then it was disco music, funk music, you know, there was no genre, and there was no such thing as calling hip-hop.
Right.
You know, that was that thing. So just decided on the name Spectrum, and it just kind of fit. And so now when the party was happening, like, hey, we want Spectrum to come through. You know, you call the youth center, you get my brother and his crew, and I'm tagging along. I'm little dude tagging along, just trying to hang out. Like, this is kind of cool. You know, this is how I get to, I don't know, hang out and hang with the older kids. And my mom's like, well, it's for the youth center. Okay.
Oh, it's okay.
Yeah, it's okay.
It's
because
safe, yeah.
The youth center was run by the adults. And, you know, they was our football coaches and basketball coaches. So it was that kind of thing. So, okay, I know you're in good hands with them and your brother's there and nothing happens and stuff like that. So it was kind of safe there.
Crazy. And it's funny. You told me actually your mom would be working the door at some of those parties.
Oh, man.
Taking the money.
That came after we broke off from the youth center and then we started doing our own parties.
Yeah.
Because me and Hank would do parties, and because I'm getting my DJ skills. I got another partner, Jerry J. He actually taught me how to actually spin and blend because he was from Freeport. He was nice.
Who is this?
Jerry J. Jerry Jackson. So we call him Jerry J. He's nice. So back then, he was one of the nicest blends DJ back then. And then we used to have our little rivalry with Freeport and Hempstead. And it was like, you know, a little competition. But I was tagging along. I'm getting older. I'm going into the ninth grade. So now I'm hanging out a lot more. So I was like, well, I'm in the ninth grade. I'm not in private school anymore. Now I'm back in public school. So I'm like, I'm hanging out with everybody. So now as we start going on, my brother's like, yo, we should just throw some parties. You know, okay. So find out how we can get a place. We'll rent a place. You usually take the money that we earned or from working summer jobs and stuff like that and little offside jobs and put it together. And then all of a sudden, well, we need somebody that's who's going to watch the door, you know. So, hey, Ma, you want to watch the door? So
bless,
she was
her heart for doing it,
she
man.
She was like, you know, because she always wanted to make sure we was good and stuff right. like that. She will, man, she said, okay, I'll watch the door. She would be watching the door, boy. She didn't let nobody slide, boy. Nah, he didn't pay. That one didn't pay. We were like, you know, and I got my, you know, as we're getting on, Hank got his friends. We got our friends. You know, everybody's in there getting up to like 18. So they are security. So they watching the door, make sure nothing goes down. But my mom's, man, we did some parties, boy. She was like, oh, you kids are wild. But she always wanted to be like, y'all need my help. I'm there and I'll get you guys. And she was always at the door, man. It was kind of, I bring it up, I think about it. That was kind of crazy, too. While I was working.
If your mom in the middle of these wild parties.
Because, yeah. You know, sometimes a little hectic at the front door. My mom's in the middle like, I told you, and I know your parents, and I'm... And everybody's nice. Going crazy, man.
Amazing. You told me one time some guy even flashed a gun at her.
Oh, one guy wanted to fight her. And it was funny because this was later on. I think I'm in the 11th grade, and we had this party at the VFW. And this guy, you know, Michael Christmas, he's trying to get into the party. He wants to, you know, he's one of the what we call, you can call him now, and nowadays would be like, he's one of the bullies of the town. But we had a lot of those. Roosevelt had a lot of them. Like, it was like, who had the best hands, that's who was going to control the situation.
Right.
So who can fight the best. So he was one of those dudes that was just, you know, just thought he was there. Because he was a big guy, you know. Must have been like 6'4", you know, kind of stocky. So he wanted to, you know... He tried to get slick on my mom's and didn't want to pay. I was like, yo, I paid her. And he's calling, cursing out her, calling all kinds of like, yo, we like, yo, wait a minute, hold up. So we kind of hemmed him up. But Mike still wanted to fight. Like, yo, she like, so my other guys, because I'm DJing,
right.
My other friends, Jerry and his crew, they come to the front and defuse the whole situation. And they was like, yo, if he comes back, one of my man's Satchel's like, he's mine, because he don't know what I know. So it was like, it got crazy. Then all of a sudden, I know, sad story to him, you know, like 2 weeks later, it was in the paper. My mom was like, she was reading the paper and, you know, they found him dead. Somebody shot him. So my mom was like, is that the guy that wanted to fight me at the party? I said, yeah, that's the guy. I said, see, that's what he, you know, he didn't mean like, was it, see, God don't like ugly. You know, so, you know, it was
oh,
like,
man.
It would get hectic, man. Cats would come in. But, you know, basically, we didn't have too many of those altercations because we was those guys that everybody respected. And we earned the respect on the streets. Like, nah, man, you don't do that to them because, and at the same time, they didn't know who we would bring. So, we barely had, you know, bad incident.
I've seen those early Public Enemy promo photos where everyone's strapped.
Yeah. So, you know,
86, 87.
That was the 86, 87. That was, man, that was the 9-8 posse. So I tell you how that song came about. Chuck wanted to do a record.
You're going
to
get yours?
Yeah, you're going to get yours. You know, me and Chuck was hanging out. He said, yo, man, I want to do a song about cars. What's going on? I said, yo, man. I said, Chuck, you going to do that? You know what everybody's riding. And he said, what's that? I said, they riding 98s, Oldsmobile 98s. And he was like, word? So I took him uptown. We was in Long Island. And I said, see, everybody got the 98s. the Oldsmobile 98s. Those were the like gangster cars back right. then. If you had one of them, you was just down. So yeah. So he said, all right. Then he came up with the 98 Posse.
No, you hate my 98. You're gonna get yours. Cruising down the boulevard. I treat it like some superstar. You know the time, so don't look hard. Get with it, the ultimate homeboy car. All your suckers in the other rides. Wherever I'm coming, get to my side. My 98 is tough to chase. If you're on my tail, better watch your face.
Wow. So he didn't actually have a...
He just wanted to, I gave him the direction of where to go.
That's amazing.
And then he took that and took it to left. And then the guys that's in the picture, they all had 98s.
They all had the 98s.
You know, so they was like, you know, some of them cats. I mean, they was like people we knew, our friends, and you know, we
right.
come to our parties and everybody was good, you know. But you needed during that time, during the 80s, you needed that kind of crew.
Sure. You know, so just to, you know, we'll go back to Adelphi and all that stuff in a minute, but just while we're on the first P record, there was a 6-month delay between when Yo Bum the Russia Show was finished and when it was released, right? And hip hop was moving so fast in those days that, you know, even though you'd spent, I think, 3 years working on that record, it was in some ways outdated by the time it came out. What do you think might have been different if there'd been less of a holdup between when it was finished and when it was released?
Truthfully, I don't know what it might have been different. It's kind of hard to say because it the whole culture was still new. But one thing about hip-hop, once you get your record, back then you had to put it out because, like you said, the climate changes like every 3 months. There's something new. So, I mean, our stuff was held up. And I think it was held up mainly because this is the time when Rick and Russell are not seeing eye to eye.
Right.
You know, Russell wanted to do R&B with Def Jam. And Rick was like, no, this is a hip-hop label. So that came about and all that issue came out.
The differences in vision between Def Jam co-founders Rick Rubin and Russell Simmons would come to a head in 1988 when Rubin would leave the company and form the Def American label.
I don't know if anything would have been different because... It's hard to say, man. You know, that was the album that kind of, when people heard it, it was different. It was like, oh, yeah, it's cool, but it was weird because they haven't heard, the thing I think that held it up, they haven't heard lyrics like that coming from anybody that was so conscious-driven and community-driven and focus on the young black youth as being targets.
Some people think that we plan to fail. Wonder why we go under or we go to jail. Some ask why we act the way we act without looking how long they kept us back. Mind over matter.
You know, so nobody talked like that.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, we go to KRS-One, his first album, they was talking about shooting.
Gangsta.
Record, like, yeah.
This is KRS-One. Been to a crack dealer by the name of had to buck him down with my 9mm. He said I had
because they on the cover with grenades and guns and straps and, you know, they like everybody was like that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we came out and it was kind of different because everybody was still in the brag and boast. And I think we still had this. If it came out earlier, I think it still would have been the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because everybody was in bragging and boasting how bad they are and stuff like that. We came at a whole other angle at the government. You know, things we didn't like.
Takes a nation of millions to hold me back. Rejected and accepted as a communist. Claim a fame to my name as a terrorist. Making money in corners that you'll never see. Dodging judges and the lawyers in the third degree. Nothing wrong with us.
You know, we didn't like the way the police was handling us in the hood. We all treated the same way, whether we went to college or not. They don't even know, you know. So from that perspective, I just think I think it still would have did the same because more so than the music, the beats side was kind of different. It was more the lyrics where everybody was like, wow, you know, I'm in the first, you know, when I heard My Uzi Weighs a Ton on radio. Like, now, I'm talking about primetime radio on Jeff Fox show when he was at Kiss FM. And he played it, and he had to explain what My Uzi Weighs a Ton meant. Because this is the 80s. When you hear Uzi, everybody's getting shot. This was kind of different. And that's one of the reasons why I think they played it. Now, you know, Kiss FM, they didn't play hip-hop. This is all R&B and stuff like that. But when they played that, and he explained it, it was like, okay, this is a different twist to it. And that's one of the things that I think, even if it came out on time when it was supposed to, those lyrics in there was still kind of, you know, pro-black, pro-this. And, you know, and I can go at it with, even with the first album, it was so pro-black, you know, black politicians was like, oh, no, you can't say that. You can't. Well, we're not talking about killing nobody. Right. We just talking about the system. They didn't want to hear that. They didn't want to hear that part.
How involved were you in Yo Bum Rush, a show?
I wasn't involved at all. I was involved. Listen, the much as I was involved with is, you know, because I had left because I had, you know, I had my daughter and, you know, I had issues. I had to take care of her and get a job and all this other stuff. I had my daughter going on. So in Yo Bum Rush, a show, I'm going to tell you, the only thing I really had involvement in was actually Public Enemy Number One. The first single.
The
first song, which was a demo tape.
I show you my gun, my Uzi weighs a ton, because I'm Public Enemy Number One.
So that was the one.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, before I left the group for a minute, and then they came back and got me, you know, I had did this other kid that got signed, True Mathematics. I had did After Dark.
Like a graveyard when it's day outside, but after dark is when the dead come alive. The old, the young, the black and white, they all come out in the shadows of the night, but in the daytime.
And that's how he got signed. So if you want to say kind of the involvement of me putting things together was everybody's deal.
Right.
You know, the guy that got hooked on, because me and Chuck was in the studio doing Yo Bum's show, and I was, because, you know, it was a pause tape, and I had to show him how to use, okay, you got to use a pause tape like this, Chuck, and you got to work this like this, and, you know, because it was an 0.5 second delay on the cassette before the tape stopped. So we had to, like, it was like...
I saw a great photo Harry Allen took of Chuck in front of a dual cassette deck with, like, the Radio Shack headphones on, all that stuff.
That was our production studio. So, you know, it was there, and so... That was the main one. And then even when coming back, and they had most of the second album done, except for songs like Bring the Noise and stuff like that.
Little songs like that.
Eric was my cousin. Well, we can talk about that. We can go down. You want to go to there? We can.
We can keep a chronological
sequence going.
Well, you know, I wanted to ask just for a second about the coming together of Public Enemy, right? Because a lot's been said about that, but I was a little curious about some of the exact chronology, right? Because it all centers around BAU. It all centers around the radio station at Delphi University. You have a show on there. Flavor has a show on there. Chuck's helping with your show. How did that happen?
You know, the BAU was like, you got to understand, me and Griff was DJ partners before that. And we was called the KGs. So when Griff left, you know, Chuck comes along. But Chuck comes along, like, you know, a little later. And because... I got to give you, before we get there, I got to show you, you know, because as DJs, you know, back then, we never had an MC because, you know, we played disco music and dance music and ain't nobody talking. You know, and I wasn't a talker. I wasn't a cat to get on a mic because there's a level of having to be an MC because I felt if you couldn't MC like Hollywood, Eddie Cheeban, all of them, get off the mic.
Stay off the mic.
Stay off the mic. Yeah. Stay off the mic. So we never had one. So I used to have MCs get on whoever I thought was hot. And if they was and if they sucked, I just turned the mic off. Like, get off my mic. Give me my mic and get off. You know, one cat, I almost knocked one cat out because, yo, you got that, man. Don't start with me right here. It's my show. So, yeah. It was that. And so when Griff left, and I never had a DJ name. So here, so my brother.
So you took the name of the group.
Let me tell you, Chuck is a mastermind at giving people's name. So when he comes to the crew, right, he's giving everybody names. So he was like, Keith, man, you got to have a name. And as when I was DJing that, I was so nice. You know, he used to call me the Wizard of the Wheels. So he said, yo, I'm just going to call you KG. But that's what me and Griff used to call ourselves. Keith and Griff. We used to call ourselves the KGs.
I was wondering where that came
from. Yeah, we used to call ourselves the KGs. Basically patterned after Kool & the Gang's little brother's band, the KGs. Damn, we do everything as a science behind, right? So now, when he gave me my name, KG, everybody thought it was the way me and Griffey spelled K and a G. No, he took the spelling from the Nightlighters that did a song called KG, but it was spelled K-J-E-E. So when I spell it out, people are like, was it KJ? No, KG.
Maybe,
so it's a sign. It's like, yeah. we don't mess around, man, when we give people names.
Yeah.
It's you have a name because, and Chuck taught us this, there's a story behind it once you figure out because you have to have that story.
It's funny because I saw something your brother said about how he also thought about that stuff because he was influenced by like working at, I think he said like a rock record store,
he
heavy metal
record
store. Yeah, so
and
it was
Record
like
World
was, Iron Maiden and yeah, Dead Iron Kennedys Maiden. And all this stuff.
My brother was into names too.
Yeah.
So when him and Chuck get together, it's ridiculous. But Chuck was great at naming the artists. So, there's so much dynamics to this, and people like it's hard to sum it up, man.
Of course.
So my brother was into names. So here's how we got his name. Here's how we got his name. We're watching the man, you got Dirty Harry running out, the gauntlet coming out. So he actually took the name from the gauntlet when he was Ben Shockley.
Clint Eastwood is back in the gauntlet.
You're flying to Las Vegas, coming back with a prisoner for us.
My name is Shockley, and we've got a plane to catch. Let's go.
Shockley's got to be stopped. Stopped hard.
Open fire!
And that's how you got your...
That's what we... To your president life. And Hank, when he was DJing, we used to call him President Hank Shockley. But then instead of spelling it with the Y, like our last name,
like the character,
because it rhymes with our last name.
Mm-hmm.
I can't divulge my last name,
right.
But it rhymes with my government last name.
Right.
We just changed the Y to an E because it looks better on print.
Amazing. And so, to kind of jump ahead for like you meet Flavor, and he has his own show.
Put out a little something for all the ladies, man. You know what I'm saying? Who think they the queen of the world? So I got my man Mello D on the wheels of steel, and he about to cut it up with me. Ready, Mello? Hit it, man. Hey, ladies of the world, how do you do? My name is Flavor, and I got rap just for you. It's dedicated to the ladies with the sensitive touch. To any lady that can make me love her just as much. So all the good.
Did you have to convince him that he would be a good foil to Chuck, or did he kind of get it immediately?
See, all that was built in as we was all hanging out together. So Flavor used to hang out with us because Flavor came along. Well, here's another thing, and I tried to figure this out. Flavor's 4 years older than me, all right? He was on my little league football team. And I'm trying to figure that out because he's the same age as my brother. But Flavor was a little guy. He's a little guy, so he looked younger than what he was.
Right.
And he was kind of small, he couldn't play. So it's kind of funny, but we go, that. But Flavor's always been around. But we had, as BAU was getting stronger, we was putting together rap groups. But then one rap group that put themselves together was Townhouse 3. Those were Flavor's boys, because Flavor hung out in Freeport more so than in Roosevelt.
And Townhouse 3 would later be Sons of Berserk.
Sons of Berserk. So that was their boy. And Flavor used to just come around and hang out and answer phones and do this. But he was a comedian, too. And he was kind of funny. And he was, you know, jokes would come back and forth. And like us, we jokes was 24/7 because we hang out with a bunch of comedy kids. And so going up to BAU, you know, we had another friend of ours, Steve White, that did a lot of, he used to be in a lot of Spike Lee movies. He's another comedian from Roosevelt. So him and, there was this one funny thing, him and Flavor had this snap off at White Castle's 4 a.m. after, you know, it was funny as shit. It was so funny, but Flavor knew how to hold his own with jokes. He was killing them. So, I mean, with him going around, and he would just do the unusual thing. And he kind of, like, charmed his way on to getting his own show. It was like, y'all see the Flavor of Love? It was like that. Like, no, you got to give him his own show. You just didn't think about it. So when the Def Jam, you know, the Def Jam situation came along, Rick and them only wanted Chuck. They didn't want nobody else. And Chuck was like, oh, man, there's too many damn solos out here. You know, Chucky D. You know, Chucky, we call Chucky D. And later just dropped the IE. But Chucky D and Heavy D and Schoolie D and Spider D and Kumo D. And you know, everybody was, you know, a D and a D. And everybody had that D. You know, everybody had that D after. So it was like, well, what's different than him, than these? But we was always into groups. So Chuck used to do, this is what he used to do. He was kind of, him and Hank was talking about, we all talk about things. But Chuck, because he's an artist, he would sit around and draw the concepts. So we had this crew that we wanted to put together called Funky Frank and the Street Force. And it had the symbol of the scope, you know? So we never felt that
group. Were there
going to
be people in that?
We were just going to put a group together. Oh, we just find the artists, put them in the group. And we didn't care. We'll put people together. You good? You nice? You want to do this? You want to do this? Everybody's like, yeah, okay. And then we'll go through combing how they sound with each other. You know, so then, you know, Chuck had names for all kinds of things because he would just sit up and then draw and think about it. So when the situation came for Public, you know, for Public Enemy, it was they wanted Chuck. But him and Hank sat together like, nah, man, we got to do something that nobody's out there doing, you know? So we, and being from our Long Island bringing and how we was raised, you know, yes, we had street sense, street knowledge. We knew all the street cats. We knew all of them, you know? So, but we just didn't want to do that. We'd be like, it's not us. We ain't trying to be that. We got sense and knowledge. So comes up with a concept like, yo, man, with Griff influence, and our influence from the Nation of Islam, we need to uplift the male black youth because we're going through turmoil. You know, this is during the Reaganomics. You know, we're going through turmoil. We're coming from Adelphi. We're getting treated like we just robbed somebody. You know, so like, and the cops is pulling us over. They're following us. We're getting stuff like, and this is suburbs. We're getting stuff like, if you're driving your parents and they got a nice car, they pull you over. What are you doing with this car? Well, this is my parents' car. You ain't supposed to have a nice car like this. We're getting stuff like that. And after a while, man, you know, you're like, wait a minute. We go to college, man. Y'all treating us like we drug hustling. But at the same time, we know them. You know, right. It's like, so it's kind of mixed in. But they couldn't distinguish us from whether we're cool kids or we drug hustling.
And that's where the idea of the guy in the crosshairs.
The crosshair.
Right.
No, they just got a target. They don't care what you're doing. They don't care if you got a doctor's degree. If you dress like you, you know, like your peers, because that's the way we dress, you considered that. You're a thug. So that whole thing came about that. So, and then we was always about groups. So, okay, y'all want to think we that? This is what we're going to portray to y'all. You know, the Black Panther-ish. You know, Chuck with the lyrics. But one thing we understood from DJing, and MCing. With those kind of lyrics, we knew America wasn't going to understand it. It was harsh. It was harsh for black people to understand. We was getting, politicians were saying we was the worst thing that ever happened. Now, they were treating us worse than drug dealers. And I didn't understand that. You know, we're talking about our survival, and they're treating us like we're drug dealers. So how do you offset the balance? Because from DJing, we get to feel how people are. From old people, because we're not just, here's the one thing about us DJing. We're not just doing park jams. We're doing bar mitzvahs. We're DJing for Italian people. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. They are hiring us because we had a kid with us that knew all those people, and we'll go from a wedding to a street party.
Right.
You know, we'll hang. I did a party. We did a party, man. I had to pay nothing but Vic Damone and Frank Sinatra. It was crazy. He got to play it well.
Right.
And then we'll slip our kind of music in, and they were like, oh, what is this? This is kind of good. So we understood the trait.
Right. So you know to appeal to different audiences.
Yeah, we know the difference of the audience.
Yeah.
So this is where our whole system came about. How do you digest what we're about to spit to you?
You make it a little lighter with
make
some,
it a little
like,
lighter with the court jester.
Yeah.
But Flavor was a character that you would draw to because you would turn off from us. We know that. A Flavor would keep you there. So that's when, you know, Chuck and my brother just like, yo, we'll just do this. But then we already had that combination already because we're throwing parties. Flavor's there with Chuck. You know, Flavor, Chuck is emceeing. Flavor's just kind of backing them up. We was already doing it. We just, we refined it as Public Enemy.
Yeah.
You know.
That's amazing. And I wanted to talk about the music that you guys did in relation to Chuck's voice for a second. Chuck obviously has very powerful low voice, right? First word on the second album is bass, right? And mm-hmm. not accidentally.
Yeah, boy.
Bass. How low can you go? Death row.
Listening back to a lot of the Public Enemy records to prepare for this, a lot of them don't have bass lines in the traditional sense. Mm-hmm. And even the ones that do, stuff like Fight the Power, it's very, very minimal. Bars go by with no bass, right? Mm-hmm. Half a bar, mm-hmm. a bar and a half in some of the later, you know, stuff. So there's very little bass in a traditional sense, or sometimes none on the records, but you have a guy with this like huge bass voice. Can you sort of talk about that mix?
It's kind of, you know, the start was again, DJing and playing a lot of records. We understood that. We understood Whitesnake as opposed to the Supremes. You know what I'm saying? You know, we understood the difference.
Yeah.
So with that, and we knew one thing about rap that we understood from our perspective, and when you want to get a point across, you got to be loud as hell. And that was the thing about Chuck's voice was bassy. And he was my MC. You know, like, it was my MC we doing these parties. We got nightclubs we doing. He my MC. On the ones and two, my man, Wizzy KG on the WIZARD. Chuck was like, yes. You know, we already had that. So we knew that. So the thing was, how do we make our music complement that? You know, from the first album. And truthfully, mostly it just came by just playing around. You know, or try tracks. We knew, Hank knew how hard he wanted the records to be. It has to be this way. It has to be that way. And Eric, in the beginning, was like, okay. Because Eric was great. My cousin Eric was great programmer. Eric, he gonna kill me if he hear this. Eric wanted to be Prince. He gonna kill me. I don't care.
Music ended up pretty far from Prince,
it
man.
Pretty far. But we stole a lot of stuff from Prince. So it was like Eric was really good at programming what we had because he was like our super musician. He was a musician that really didn't care. You know, we dealt with musicians that cared. Like, oh, no, it has to be. No, this is hip hop. We knew We understand that. We understand keys, registered, changes, going up a half step. We understood that. We didn't want none of that. So Eric was the best person that didn't care, hung out with us, understood what we were, who we were, and all he did was like, okay, we'll just give it a timing. That's where the whole sound come from. And understanding DJing, you know, and sound systems, you know, you got your high, mids, and lows. So that's how your records had to be. As long as you can separate those high, mids, and lows. And then the next thing was we understood performance in front of people. We always made our records that you can perform in front of people and it sounds the same. That's what a lot of people don't understand. They make a record one way, and especially like today, they make records and they kind of soft and you hear it, but when they go out live, they have to yell it because live is a whole nother feeling. You know what I'm saying? Unless, you know, your stuff is perfect, you're doing perfect singing, but you still go above because it's a performance. You got to add it. We just said, all right, we're going to cut that out. We're just going to put the performance on the records. But make it sound like a song. It's a lot of, you know, it's a lot of things that go in depth in with this stuff that we do that people don't think we did. It's just that we just did that. But we did that by experimenting with things. We'll try this, or that don't work. And we'll try the next thing. That don't work. Let's try this other thing over here. Oh, that works. So we all stay with that.
Can you talk about the sense of time on the records? I ask about this because I was listening to like Bring the Noise, for example. And I don't know if on that particular song, but on some of them, it sounds like the time is not just looped. Some of the drum parts sound like they're being played.
We had a bunch of that. We had the loops and the drums being played under it. Eric was kind of a guy that wanted, because Eric did the Bring the Noise. So he was the kind of guy that like, his genius is bananas because he loved the way we played records when we DJed. But he would take that and it's like, okay, if I sample this, but I'm going to make sure the timing, that it doesn't feel like a loop. Mm. But it is a loop. And when you hear it, oh, it is a loop, but then it has movement in it that is not feeling like a loop.
That's the thing that I wanted to get
That's
at. Yeah,
all feel. That's all feel. You know, it's like, and sometimes we'll just be in there like, okay, here's the loop. We're matching the kick up. We're truncating the sample. So, and you got to understand, we had primitive equipment back then. It's kind of like crazy, right? Like, oh, primitive equipment, you know? But that was that thing. And sometimes we like things not to be perfect. The imperfection was designed. It wasn't like, oh, we just couldn't get it right. No, some of that was designed to be that way, you know, because we wanted that kind of a feel.
Yeah.
You know, so the timing of that was like, you know, we did a lot of truncating. We did a lot of stacking, you know, of sounds. And then we did things to where the point where, like I said, it didn't feel like a loop. Sometimes, you know, it will spend a long time doing just a two-bar drum track with loops and kicks and snares and hi-hats and programming it to the point and then doing programs where it moves so it doesn't sound like. And that comes from understanding Motown records where you listen to a James Jamerson. He's always moving on his bass line.
The game of love is such a beautiful game. If you've got time, little girl, I'd like to explain all the do's and don'ts.
You know, he don't always stay in the loop. But with hip-hop, you got to have some of that. But then at times, you have to have variations. So we'll do that. That's what a lot of people didn't do.
That's fascinating.
You know, everybody just took loops and just, I'm a two-ball loop and I'm just going to stay there.
Right, quantize it and put it out.
We'll do small variations. Yeah. It's tedious, but Eric loved that, you know. I got into, you know, I'll do that a lot of times. Like, now I'm just like, sometimes I'm like, oh, it's so tedious doing that. And then nowadays, like, nobody really kind of care anymore. <Yeah. laughs>
One of the other trademarks of Bomb Squad production, you guys did this with P, you did it a lot with Young Black Teenagers and a bunch of other stuff, was the use of vocal samples.
I put
this together too. The bells of those that boost the dose of lack-a-lack and those that sell the black. Shame on the brother when he...
How did you even have in your head, oh, I'm going to take the word rock from Aretha Franklin, and I'm going to take, you know, the numbers 1 through 6 from this, you know, hip hop record no one remembers, and I'm going to take like this and that from all of it. You know, how did you have like a giant book where you had everything everyone said on a record?
Well,
you look it up, like
you are very close. Our record collection was, you know, we didn't alphabetize it. We had too many records, so Chuck devised the Dewey system, just 1 through 1 billion. So we wrote down every record that we had in the book. So instead of just going through fingering, you went through the book. And knowing what a lot of the records were, you know, either Chuck were right, or we'll be like, if I'm in the producer, like Young Black, I'm in the producer, and I was like, oh, they did a phrase. And I remember, oh, shit, they did a phrase just like maybe Aretha Franklin record. And we'll just say, or Temptations. They said a phrase that maybe of David Ruffin said. And if I remembered it, or one of us remembered it, we'll go in and line it up and put it in so you get that extra. Right. You can't do that now because the sample police is like,
right.
We want 75% of your record because you put that dude in there.
Right.
So I can't do that no more. But back then, when we had free reign to do anything, creativity was at its all-time high. Yeah, we'll sit down and line it up. Yeah, we knew it that much.
Right. And Fear of Black Planet, you know, very different record than Nation in a lot of ways. One of the ways on a technical level, it's different. You guys are experimenting more with vocal processing.
Yeah.
On a couple of the songs on like Probably Want a Cracker and things like that.
She wants a lover right now, but not no brother. A man gotta have a lot of money. Get under her cover now, she's a fine.
Well, that got into, you know, like the Nation was more, my brother wanted some, he wanted something for the streets and the penitentiary. You know, but you know, the Fib came, evolved into more so like between me and Eric, I kind of took most of the lead, and as a DJ, I'm always about what hits people. But, you know, we start experimenting with vocals because we always try to be like, you need something different so the audience don't get bored with you. You know, you sound the same way all the time, they will get bored with you. Don't care how hot you are, they'll get bored with you. So we try to do different things, like we did Reggie Jackson.
Check out the drum kick. I'm here to live for the love of my people, kicking it all about the building. So all the children are for the self-destruction. So long, I'm gonna do y'all a favor.
It was our version of taking a reggae vibe and kind of flipping it to feeling something different, but not feeling like we're trying to make a reggae record, because we respect people's art and people's genre. So even though I'm part West Indian.
I was going to say, you know, I'm part West Indian. Yeah.
But making reggae records, like, that's like, I wouldn't make a reggae record if it ain't as good as Sly and Robbie.
Drummer Lowell Sly Dunbar and bassist Robbie Shakespeare are a Jamaican rhythm section and production duo who have played on a staggering 200,000 mostly reggae and dub recordings since the 70s. In addition to performing with almost every major Jamaican artist from Peter Tosh to Sean Paul, they have performed with or produced for Bob Dylan, Mick Jagger, Sinead O'Connor, Sting, Joe Cocker, and countless others.
You know what I'm saying? And call that reggae. I would make a variation of it. Now, dancehall is kind of different. You know, I messed around with some dancehall music, but that's kind of like R&B, hip hop, and like you move around in that. That's what, but actually reggae, like Bunny Whaling them, like I'm like that hot, but we'll make a variation as a respect to them that we like this and we'll do some different things with it. You know, so that's the Fear of a Black Planet was more, and it was more, you know. The issues that's what's going on with us, we just turned that into the records. But we try to give it, and within that, We didn't let the issues that was going on with us. Chuck had things to get off his mind.
I got so much trouble on my mind. Refuse to lose. Here's your ticket. Here the drama get wicked.
But at the same time, me and Eric is sitting there making sure, and mainly me, is making sure we don't get lost into what he need to get off his mind. We still got an audience and an obligation to keep to them so it doesn't seem like we're just mad guys. You know, like, and you couldn't hear it. We didn't want that heard in the record. We wanted the music to make you feel something.
Right.
So that's, you know, that's what, and then when Chuck writes, it's like, and another thing that people missed that we did a lot, we'll do a basic track, Chuck will drop his lyrics, and then we'll score the music around it.
Mm. You mentioned that before, this idea that like so much of what you did as producers was almost orchestrators, right? You're coming mm-hmm. in behind a vocalist yep. to support a vocalist.
It's like scoring a movie. And we, because the other side of us, we was movie nuts. We loved yeah. movies, you know, we loved score, and then we loved the scoring of things. So we would sit down and study a record and listen to it. Okay, let's put this little piece in there that kind of fits. You know, let's put this in there. And everything had to make sense. You hear all records, nothing in there that doesn't make sense.
Yeah. And so one of the craziest things in researching for this that I found out was Fight the Power, obviously probably Public Enemy's most famous song, mm-hmm. arguably one of the most famous rap songs of all time. Almost didn't happen because Spike Lee had a very different vision about what he wanted for the end of Do the Right Thing. Why don't you tell me about that?
All right. My brother's funny. He'll tell you. But it was two things. This is what we didn't let people do. Don't tell us how to do. We should do your record. You give us the concept. We'll come back. We're going to know what to do. So, you know, Spike wanted a version of Lift Every Voice and Sing. And as people, and as DJs, and as, you know, and we doing, we kind of got an understanding of how to make records. We're like, now how are we going to make that work for us? Come on, man. We are very practical and understand. We understood our lane.
Right. So he wanted something super earnest.
Yeah, he wanted something. He wanted Lift Every Voice and Sing redone. Like.
With rapping or something?
With like, I don't know. I don't know what was in his brain. We're like, yo, dude, you don't make records. We understand your concept. You don't make records. So we need to do this. You know what I'm saying? Because this is where the energy of the streets is, and you got this movie that's about that. We can't have, mathematically, it doesn't work. it's like music notes, rap world. It's hard to do that and to still keep your presence of like, this is a group. It's not like when we did the Stephen Stills song.
Mm-hmm.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear.
Man is the father, the sun is the center of the earth, in the middle of the universe. Then why is this verse coming six times rehearsed? Don't freestyle much, but I write them like such. Amongst the fiends controlled by...
You know, I was kind of totally different because, you know, we figured out how to flip that, you know, for the He Got Game project.
Right.
But this is, you know, this is Brooklyn fights and cops and heat. Like, come on, you gonna have Lift Every Voice and Sing?
It would have been a very different movie.
Like, a very different, very, and we couldn't make that hard, you know? Yeah. So us with the knowledge of records and Ronald Isley approached us.
When I interviewed him, he mentioned that he was very close to suing over that
and then decided
not to.
You know, I started to sue them. But, you know, since they were my friends, I said, hey, man, let them go on.
Really? You thought about that?
I said, man, come on. That's just, you know, this Fight the Power, that beat. I said, what do you think I said? I said, but, you know, it's the same lyric and everything, you know.
He couldn't.
Oh.
All we took was a title. We didn't take his music.
Right.
Nothing was his music, no lyrics, no melody. He goes, fight, fight the power. You got to fight the power that be.
You got to fight the powers that be.
We took that part, but we didn't steal none of his music. We just took his title. Matter of fact, we made him more famous. he would have lost that battle because of we had no music of his, no, just the maybe a word that he said, but copyrighting certain words. There are songs out there with the same titles. You know, can't put, you know, so much.
Yeah.
He had to prove that, you know, it was actually his.
Right. A lot of people view Public Enemy as existing for the first three albums and then afterwards being almost like a different group in some ways. Can you talk about the environment during the making of Fear of a Black Planet and kind of what happened afterwards?
Oh, the environment of Fear of a Black Planet.
Because you said it almost drove everyone crazy.
It's all of that, the issues that we had, you know, everyone talked about the Griff situation, all that.
In May of 1989, Professor Griff gave an interview to the Washington Times and made some anti-Semitic statements.
It was so much pulling at everybody. And I think most of it was we let the media get between us. And my brother was going in one direction. I'm trying to stay one where Eric is there, and he's kind of like moving on and, you know, still talking to Griff, like, you know, this and that. Then the record labels and then the movie houses, and everybody is coming at us. Deals are dropping, you know, from that. Deals are being restructured because of that. We're looking like, you know, this is kind of bad. And, you know, everybody's in Chuck's ear, you know, my brother's ear, you know, me, I'm just like, I'm background. I'm trying to just do beats and whatever, and me and Eric the same way. But between my brother and Chuck, and everybody's in their ear, and everybody have a different view of how things should be and how things was going, it kind of took its toll on everybody, you know? Because nobody thought we'll be in a position like this.
Do you have any regrets about that era, personally?
Nah. You know what that era? That era made hip-hop. That era made hip-hop, and it made us, and it put us, yo, man, it put us in a stratosphere that, you know, no other rap group has been in. You know, so I don't have no regrets. We never have regrets. We might have difference of opinion, but we never have regrets about what we did. Because, you know, we was a bunch of kids that was trying to figure out what to do with our lives, you know, and then started to build up, got an opportunity, and we took it to the hill.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like Chuck was in such a unique and difficult position, the 88 through 90, right, that period, because he was the face of the group in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And people took him not just for a rapper who rapped about political things, but for a political leader.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, people all over the country thought that he had the answer about whatever, black self-empowerment, whatever it was.
Well, that was the biggest thing. You know, Chuck was that voice.
Yeah.
He was that leader that that the people wanted, you know? And the end of the day, we wanted to just put an impact on the world and make some, you know, do what we can for society, especially for blacks. But, you know, Cass was like, you can almost run for office. It's like you run for president. I think it took a whole nother mountain. And, you know, but at the end of the day, to me, I always say we was just entertainers, you know, that had a message that hoped that would change people's lives. But it was like, it became so. And you understand, it was at a time where there was no leaders running around. You know, your Jesse Jackson's and them was over there. We was the age of the new youth group that was coming up. And they was like, yeah, this is what we need, you know? So it kinda took its toll. But as, you know, between the political side, but in an entertainment side, it's like we couldn't do gigs without Flavor.
Right.
That's just what it was.
Yeah.
You see the weirdness of it? You know, political side, yes. I mean, there was even a situation where Chuck's words became so powerful to people and we was dealing with the gold coming out of Africa and all that, not where gold.
In interviews and on video throughout Public Enemy's early years, Chuck D would often repeat the phrase, a gold brain is better than a gold chain. According to Chuck, quote, I knew that people in music like trends. Our concept was to wear African leather medallions or something rather than gold, because people were getting their heads taken off for wearing gold back then.
Yo, somebody questioned him about having a gold wedding band. So if you're telling them to wear gold, why you got a gold wedding band? It became that deep.
Wow.
It became like, well, this is a wedding band. It's a symbol of my marriage. No, you saying about gold, it's gold. Gold is gold. And then wow. you
being held to the standard.
You're being held to everything. Yeah. Of course, you know, you things, but then what happens is we're being held to everything. But then there's things in society that you have to deal with. You know, we have to deal with corporations. No matter how much we hate them,
right.
No matter how much we can say what they want, but they control almost 90% of everything that we need to do to make an income.
Right.
You gotta deal with
them. Right. I mean, those records were put out through Sony, right?
Yeah.
Def Jam.
Def Jam. So we gotta deal. We can talk about it, but we use that platform
right.
to make people aware. But sometimes people don't think past what they need to do and look for you to guide them and not understand, like, we're just giving you awareness of what's going on and what you need to do. You have to make the next step in your life to do what you need to do for you. Take what we give you and don't always take things for like, well, that person said it was that. No, this is what the facts are. This is what really happened.
So the first time I met you, I was asked you a little bit about Belle Biv DeVoe, and I did want to get into that. You told me that you and Eric remixed Poison into the form we know it now.
If I were you, I'd take a caution.
How bad was it when you first got it?
The song was good, but the sonics of the song we didn't think was strong enough to where it portrayed. Because Spider-Man and Freeze did a great job with the song. That's their song.
Mm-hmm.
We just, like I said, we just came in, but we just had a knack for just enhancing songs. You know, we knew how to enhance it where it wouldn't disturb and take away from Spider-Man and Freeze, because that's their record, you know? We just like to enhance it. So we just came in, changed some sounds, gave them some new updated sounds that we was rocking with, gave them some stuff and did some things, did some cool drops.
Now you know your slick blow.
It's driving me out of my mind. That's why it's hard for me to find. Can't get it out of my head. Miss her, kiss her, love her. That girl is
You know, we treated that song like we was on the dance floor.
Mm-hmm.
That's
and
why.
It worked.
And it worked. You know, this drum me out of my mind. You know, the drops, man, because we understood dance floor and like, oh, you know, that's a...
That's the moment that's when a, everyone's yeah. going to show yeah, off on the dance floor or whatever. Yeah. Amazing.
You know, and then kept that snare. Boom. Bat. 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 That's, we wanted that snare, like, gritty in your face, where it just you, when you hear it. And that's that snare, you hear that snare sound, you know that's Poison.
So you had them hanging out with rappers to try to help them transition from like the secondary guys in New Edition.
I be teasing Mike and all of them, it's funny. You know, when they first came, because they tracked Chuck down because they was on the road. And this is when they was breaking up from New Edition.
Yeah.
So they tracked Chuck down. They we going out to Belle Biv DeVoe. But we knew their manager that Mike had picked up, Hiram. You know, Hiram Hicks was, you know, one of our dudes. So he came up, got up with Chuck, and then came to my brother and was like, yo, man, I got the guys, man. They went looking to do some stuff. I was like, okay. You know, and then I was in a session at Green Street. I think I was just coming out of Terror Dome, finishing like that, and they came through, and they were like, "Yo, Keith, man, we need some heat. You know, we need." And I'm not teasing them. We need some stuff, you know. And I was like, I was kind of funny, man. I was like, y'all want to rap? I said, y'all don't look like rappers because they coming out a New Edition. Nice, neat. And they tripping on us because working with Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, they come in the studios with suits, ties. That's how they've been around with all their lives, you know? And I'm like, no, this is hip hop, dude. We come like this. So they came in nice, neat, Jerry curls. You know, I got an Ice Cube Jerry curl story too, but
we'll get to that. We'll get to that. Absolutely.
Got all of this. They got all of this, man. They in there. You know, they got the cardigans and the sweaters and the mock necks and, you know, and I'm like, dude. And this is why I was, you know, it's my wild days. I said, dude, man, y'all can't be coming in the studio like this. So I think jokingly, I wasted a studio session making jokes and, you know, because we always got tons of jokes for everybody.
Right.
We making jokes on this and that. They go out the next day and find a style. They did find a style. They came out and said, Keith, man, we went out and went to this. My man took them. Oh, I think Lionel Martin, they had a video they were shooting and took them down. They bought all this crazy clothes, what you saw on the album cover. That's what. Wow. But when I met them, they wasn't even dressed like that. You know,
amazing. Well, you said Leaders of the New School was hanging out with them at one point.
Oh, we put them together. You know, they had a crew that, you know, they didn't have a name. It was Lord Tyheen, you know, Brian, and Dingle was the only one that had his regular name.
Right.
You know, so Chuck was like,
Lord Tyheen was which one?
And Chuck already had a name, Leaders of the New School. We just didn't know who to fill it.
Right.
You know, because like I told you before, Chuck was...
Had names. Right,
had
a
names.
Bunch of things.
He already had Leaders of the New School. We didn't know how to fill it.
Right.
Those guys was it. So Chuck had did them a logo. And, you know, this was what they did the logo for. This was like, they didn't have nothing. So I'm just going to, you know, give y'all the Leaders of the New School. They was kind of feeling, but we got to fix up some names. So he, you know, Brian came to Brian and said, yo, man, we should call you Charlie Brown. Chuck is hot with this.
Yeah.
They was resisting in the beginning. And then Chuck was like, yeah, Chuck used to talk sports a lot. Yeah. So there was this kid that played for Cleveland Browns. His name was Busta Rhymes. Chuck was like, yo, that'd be a dope name for a rapper. But then when he figured out to give it to Lord Tyheen, that's what he was, which Trevor wanted to call himself.
Right.
We was like, Lord Tyheen, because he was dealing with the 5%ers then, you know? It was crazy. Chuck said, nah, man, you need a name. Here's a name that's kind of Busta Rhyme. But it was spelled Bust, B-U-S-T, a rhyme. As a play on words, we used to say, yo, all right, go ahead, Busta Rhyme right now. So, and everybody kind of, and he kind of spelled like Busta Rhyme.
Right.
You know, so that was, see, there's always a meaning behind it. You know, Brian had Charlie Brown because he reminded us of how Charlie Brown was from the Peanuts. You know, it's like he just had that glowy face, like, you know, yeah. Charlie. And
amazing.
Everybody we did have a meaning, you know.
I have to jump ahead to Ice Cube. First off, what is the Jerry Curl story you were referring to a second ago?
I got a problem when cats from the West Coast come to the East Coast and they got Jerry Curl. I was like, yo, what is this? You know, Ice Cube had his Jerry Curl. We in there like, yo, dude, you got to do something. It was funny. Him and Jinx used to call me the oldest B-boy. I was like, yo, man, all right, I'll take that. You know, so and the Jerry Curl. Then all of a sudden, after we did the album, we did Boys in the Hood, he cut that. Got hooked up, cut the Jerry Curl, changed all this stuff, and you know. it was like, cute, man. I had the Jerry Curl. I said, you looking like New Edition when it came in here.
And so that record, you know, sounds more what we think of West Coast than, you know, Public Enemy, for example.
Her payback's a motherfucking nigga. That's why I'm sick of getting treated like a goddamn stepchild. Fuck a punk, cause I ain't him. You gotta deal with the 9MMM.
Even though it has a lot of your same approaches in terms of like the layering of samples and the beat switching and all that kind of stuff. Whose influence was that, the choice of samples to make it sort of more West Coast? Was that like you guys or Jinx?
That was us. Because what we, as producers, we never looked at having a certain sound. like most producers today now. And then, you know, we know Mustard did that track. And everybody's trying to sound like him. So we never cared about that. It was always about the artists. So what we created was a West Coast environment in New York. You know, we made him go get his crew. You know, that's when he got the lynch mob, brought them up, Yo-Yo and everybody. We made them do all that stuff. And then, you know, sometimes when they had to go back and forth, Chuck was in the West Coast, he'll do some vocal parts with them and bring all the West Coast cats. We made everything sound like the West Coast, even when we did the skits.
Right, which, is it true people thought the drive-by skit actually was you recording a real drive-by?
Man. Little time, let it go. Okay. Hey, yo, man, roll the window down.
Wow. We finna get these motherfuckers.
Hey, man, what's up, nigga? Yo, this is Willis Lynch, nigga.
Smoke
nigga.
The
I started all. I started this, the skits.
Yeah.
You know how I'm making it like it's movies. So what happened was, no, it was sound effects.
Right.
I had the actual sound effects. Who produced the Star Wars? What's the producer?
Lucas.
Lucas.
Yeah.
I had the Lucas sound effects library.
Wow.
I had the actual all. So they had all, he puts out these libraries. You know, spent a grip of money. You know, getting those because I wasn't trying. So he has his Lucas library. Me and my brother went and spent, I think about $2,300 on, you know, back then it was CDs. And putting those whole skits together, we said, oh, we're going to make this like a movie. Man, because it was hip hop.
Yeah.
And then what we did was, then the next thing I did was, I had to make sure that, because me and Jinx did most of the vocals, I had to make sure I talked like them. There's a way that they talk. Like, they would use the word tripping. We would say, no, you bugging. So we did homework on that. We made that right. I was like, no. He did Endangered Species. Me and Eric did a thing where it's like, are you in the woods? You know, we kind of patterned in after Deliverance. So when they was in the woods and running through, and then, you know, I got into the point where it's like, okay, you know, there's sound effects where you're walking on gravel or walking on in woods or walking on twigs. Either you got sneaker sound walking on twigs or you got boots. So I had to figure out at the hip hop cats, so it's sneakers. So it's a whole different sound. So it went that deep. You wouldn't know it, but when you hear it, they were like, wow, this just sounds too real. So it was, you know, it was that when I did that, then Dre, when he did 100 Miles and Running, after that, when they came back to do 100 Miles and Running to compete with the Ice Cube album,
right,
he started doing all that.
They did that, right. So, he did the skits on the title track.
Started doing the skits and all that. So I kind of went in, you know, with all that. So, you know, yeah, no, the drive-by wasn't a real drive-by. And here's a slick thing. They would say rap was violent, right? So at the time, Young MC had the hottest
record. That's why you're a Young MC. I was like, put Young MC
in there. It's like, oh, no, we're listening to the Young MC and we're going to do a drive-by. So that's why people trip, like, he's listening to Young MC and they're going to do a drive-by because Young MC was that nice dude and won a Grammy and he's got the nicest record. Oh, I just fucked that up. It's like, amazing. No, this is what we listen to before we shoot somebody.
Yeah. There is so much more. The Great Adventures of Slick Rick. What was your involvement in that?
Okay. Working on a couple of songs and mixing stuff with him and sitting with him. And here's the thing about Slick Rick. Jam Master Jay did treat him like a prostitute.
I'm telling you, as Rick is my name, I wouldn't trust no girl unless she feels the same. Treat him like a prostitute. Do what? Don't treat no girly well until you're sure of the scoop.
That was kind of hot for him on his solo after he left the Get Fresh crew. But the problem is nobody wanted to work with Rick. Rick was, at the time, was kind of difficult. But when we got to him, he wasn't. So Rick was, nobody wanted to work with Rick. They threw him to us. My brother said, oh, we'll deal with him. Chuck came up with the whole concept, The Great Adventures of Slick Rick. And my brother, they sat around, him and my brother sat around, like, yo, we need to do it. Yo, we was doing that for other artists. We did that with Doug Fresh, too.
The idea of making it sort of a concept.
Kind of a concept. He didn't have a concept even for the album cover. We was like, oh, call it The Great Adventures of Slick Rick, because basically in his album, that's what he's having, Great Adventures. But Slick Rick was the first guy that I sat in. Well, L was one, a different story. But Slick was the first dude I just sat in and watched in awe of how he put those songs together, like Indian Girl and Children's Story, because Rick did every voice on them tracks. Nobody else. The backgrounds, when Indian Girl, where he got the, oh yeah, hey, oh, hey, all that, that's all him. Children's Story, all, nobody else. Rick is a master at doing those voices.
First he wanted to see the vagina face to face. Uh-huh. He opened it up with his bare two thumbs. He seen crabs with spears and Indian drums. He's going,
hey, y'all, hey, y'all, hey, y'all, hey, y'all.
The cop grabbed his arm, he started acting erratic. He said,
keep still, boy, no need for static.
Punched him in his belly and he gave him a slap. But little did he know the little boy was strapped. The kid pulled out a gun, he said, why'd you hit me? The barrel was set straight for the cop's kidney. The cop got...
But this is when he was kind of like, he was eager to get his stuff out. And then after we came, after we almost was finishing the album, we mixing it up, I come into a studio session. His mom's is in there. She's helping mixing the song. And push my boy up. Turn him up. I'm like, oh. It's funny, man. I know Rick probably don't remember none of that, but it was that thing that we sat, you know, with him. And we didn't have to do much to cultivate him. He had everything he wanted to do, man. And he's a genius, you know, when it came to storytelling, man. He's a freaking genius at that. And he makes you believe those stories. I mean, he did some voices that he changed. I was like, yo, Rick, you should keep that. That was so dope, like, especially in Children's Story. You know, he had voices in there. I was like, yo, man, you taking that out? Yeah, I don't like it. Yeah, man, I don't like it. I'm like, you serious? I said, this is hot, you know. But, you know, my thing was, and my brother, we was making sure that he, just make sure he just get his thing done the way he wanted, creative. Nobody from Def Jam was bothering him. And, you know, that was it.
Before we wind up with what you're doing today, I need to know, listen to Young Black Teenagers. And you have some pretty blatant Stones and Rush samples in there.
Oh, yeah.
The styles ain't foul, so you bleed when it hits ya. You worship my mic, I recite the type you like to bite, so don't fight the fright. Just feed from the bees of verbs and words that blur your mental. The instruments are instrumental on this journey through time, your mind, and the universe. I possess the skill of my bones, it's okay. You see, you talk to the store, I got to go, it's time to make the donuts. This way at the end of the week, yo, I collect the bones. Sunday, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, the rat is rising in the kitchen. The rest of the week, I'm zoning. The skin's a finger licking. Big brother's on me to...
Any, ever run into any trouble with those?
No, because a lot of the stuff we had replayed.
Okay. I thought there was in the Stone sample, I thought it was a mix of replaying and sampling, but maybe it was all
no,
replaying.
We replayed that.
Wow.
We had got these guys, my man Bill, he had another partner, and they was good in guitar and bass lines. And they would go home and memorize everything how they did it, and they came back in. That was kind of unique to go there like that with them. And, you know, Terminator did Tap the Bottle.
Oh, okay.
So tap the bottle and twist the cap. Come on, tap the bottle and twist the cap. Yeah, tap the bottle and twist the cap. Then pass it around the group, got the Rubio lad. Hey, yo, hickory dickory dock.
And Flash did another song for them. But Flash kind of coached them on a lot of vocals where, you know, parts where they sound like, you know, a little bit of Furious Five. And so we just took that from what Flash was teaching them and went there.
And so what are you up to right now? I know you're doing some DJing with our mutual friend Journey.
Yeah, doing that. And matter of fact, I could talk about it now because I talked about it here. I'm actually putting a documentary together about Spectrum City, you know, about us. But now I got mostly everybody still alive. So it's that kind of thing where it's going to feel like a coolie high kind of thing. Everybody's telling, yo, there's funny stories in there. There's so much funny stories. It's bananas. So it's that whole story that they're looking at, you know, turn into, you know, maybe a feature film, but mainly probably to one of the outlets, you know. So that's going down. Working on a project with Nicole and got her in there. She's like, ah. But we in there tussling. We're tussling. doing a bunch of things. Then me and Journey's finishing up trying to put together our first Spectrum City album, getting that together. But my main thing that's coming around is the doc. It's like, you know, I got Seth Mann that did a lot of The Wire. He does
and The Breaks.
He did The Breaks, so he does The Breaks and all that. So he's actually directing this. You know, I fought hard. I was like, I'm not doing this if I ain't got Seth. So and that's a big thing because we got the 30th anniversary coming up. 2017 is our 30th anniversary of being, you know, you want to call it signed or coming out. Mm-hmm. So we got a lot of big things happening. We got some things going on with the Smithsonian that year. I'm getting a street named after all of us.
Wow.
You know, Roosevelt. So it's kind of like, it's kind of going to be a big thing that whole 17 and, you know, and with the release of the doc, you know.
First Spectrum City record since Check Out the Radio.
Since Check Out the Radio, yes.
Spectrum City on your fresh M dial. On the Spectrum City roll call, we got President Hank Shockley, voice of Chucky D.
I love the beef on with Cassidy, baby.
And on turntable number one. And
turntable number two.
Is the music of the W-I-Z.
A-R-D.
Wizard K.
K-double E.
On the wheels of steel, y'all. Come on, check it out.
Is it Check Out the Radio? Yes. Yes. So, you know, so it's a big thing, man, you know. And right now just doing a bunch of little things, but, you know, I've been doing a lot of, like, keeping it real. I should say grassroots, you know, especially, you know, I work with PV and do things. So I've been building up on the grassroots things, doing DJ conventions and DJ battles with them, getting them back to where I started out with them from, because they kind of tripped out when they saw my picture from 1974. I had this crazy shirt on too. Like, not this shirt, but I had a crazy shirt on with tennis rackets. You know, back in the day, but old school used to have tennis rackets all over it. And I'm DJing with this stuff. I was like, oh, that's a horrible shirt.
Yeah, well.
I thought it was a hot thing back then, you know. So, I mean, that's it. You know, the documentary's kind of taking up a lot of time because I'm trying to make it really really in depth.
Nice. Well, we will have to have you back when it's out.
Yeah, when it's out.
There's so much stuff that we barely even scratched the surface.
Oh man, there's so much stuff, man, that's going on. You know, me and Chuck got a bunch of things we're putting together. So it's there, you know. So I don't like to talk about stuff till I really have it, but I give a little bit out, just a little bit, and then when it comes through, you know, we go down. So
all right. Well, Keith Shockley, thank you so much for coming by, man.
Thanks for having me.
The early work of the Bomb Squad was absolutely formative for me. The albums they did with Public Enemy and Ice Cube helped me discover many important things about politics, history, and culture. But even apart from the lyrical content, the music was influential and educational. Even now, in this interview with Keith, I'm still learning things about drum programming, arrangement, and sampling. Lessons I began to learn by first hearing his work decades ago. It was a pleasure to talk to Keith, and I very much hope that there's a part two with him in the future. I hope you enjoyed hearing the conversation with him as much as I enjoyed having it. Join us next week when our guests will be Nice and Smooth. They're celebrating their 30th anniversary as a group, and we'll take them through it all, from their beginnings teaming with Bobby Brown and T. LaRock, all the way to their current tour. Trust me when I say there are heart-stopping moments in this episode you won't want to miss. Like I said at the beginning, make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice. If that app is iTunes, it's hugely important to give us a rating or a review. And don't forget to visit patreon.com/thecyphershow if you enjoy the program, and help us out with as little as a dollar a month. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
Get off my mic. Give me my mic and get off.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Is that the guy that wanted to fight me at the party?
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
We're doing Bar Mitzvahs.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
Hey, you're only in the 8th grade.
Thanks to our newest Patreon supporter, Walter Thomas.
Later on, Ronald Reagan took that away.
And a special thanks to the best dinner party hostess in New York, Sophia Chang, for setting up my initial introduction to Keith.
We was just entertainers, you know, that had a message that hope that would change people's lives.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
No, the girls I don't want to talk about, they ain't in my brain.